Daniel chapter 11. We left off at verse 35 last time we were together. K.P. O'Hannon says hello to you. I'll talk with him this afternoon. It's good to hear his voice. I heard a story. I don't know if it's a true story or not. I'll let you be the judge of it. There's a man, he was sitting in his favorite chair in his home. And all of a sudden he heard a knock on the door. And as he went to the door, he looked down, and there's a snail there. And he picked up that snail and he looked at it. About 2 months later, he heard another knock on his door. He opened up the door and there was a snail, and he looked down and he looked up at him and said, "What was that all about?" Well, as I watch faces, and sometimes people think that this whole thing is a one-way communication thing. You guys communicate back to me. And as I watch some of your faces in the teaching of Daniel, I think I expression, "What was that all about?" There's one poor young lady who fellowships here who had just had her wisdom teeth pulled out, all four of them. So she listened to that study under the influence of Vicodin. So you wonder, what in the world does she get out of it? But as you're dealing with names like Ptolemy, Lucius, Philopater, and Antiochus Epiphanes, it's easy to sit there and just start to glaze, and you think, Ptolemy Shamalemy, what in the world does this have to do with me, and how can I get out of here? And it would be very easy to look at, for instance, these first 35 verses of Daniel chapter 11 and think, you know, wouldn't it have been just nice to summarize those 35 verses by simply saying these were prophecies that God gave concerning the Persian and the Grecian Empire. They have been fulfilled by those empires in the past, and then move into the prophecies that have to do with the future and have the most to do with us. And why would anyone go over all those names and try and lay out kind of the historical context of all of those prophecies? And you begin to think that the guy must be mad. And you think it would be just enough to do a simple overview, but it wouldn't have been enough, and I'll tell you why. When a person sees the details of the prophecies fulfilled to the perfection the way that they were, then it builds into our lives the confidence and the needed confidence that every prophecy in this book that has to do with the future is going to be fulfilled to just that detail, just that perfection. We're going to see a little bit later in this reading of the book of this last section of the book of Daniel, that the book of Daniel was given for Daniel, was given for the Jews that were going to go through that persecution under the Persians and under the Grecians. But principally, the book is given for those who will be living in the last days. In other words, he gave a series of prophecies that he knew were going to be fulfilled 22, 23, 24 hundred years ago. And he listed those in order to encourage those that were going through the difficulty of that time. But he gave those prophecies in order that we might sit in a room like this in 1999, look back on those prophecies, see them fulfilled in the way that they were, and then look to the future, look to the circumstances of the day in which we live with absolute confidence that God is going to win, that his word is going to be fulfilled, and that the key is that every human being on the face of planet Earth choose the winning side, and there's only going to be one winning side. And so the beautiful way that he works the details gives the early prophecy so that we'll have the great confidence that we need, knowing that in the last days horrific times will come upon the earth, and we would need that bolster to our faith that fulfilled prophecy gives. Now, in this verse 6, God begins in all of chapter 10, 11, and 12, or at least the first four verses of chapter 12. They're cutting in the middle of a prophecy. But the prophecy takes a turn at verse 36. Up to verse 35, it's been dealing with Persia, it's been dealing with Greece, it's been dealing with the Grecian Empire divided into its four smaller sections, and then mainly the battles that had to do with the northern Syrian part of that divided Grecian Empire, and its battle against the southern part of that divided Grecian Empire that was centered there in Egypt. And the reason it was concentrated on was because those two fighting with one another, they just constantly tromped through the most precious real estate in all of the world, and that is through the land of Israel, the home of the Jews. And so he detailed all of that for us, and we ended with God giving these amazing prophecies concerning a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, who fulfilled the prophecies up to verse 35. Now in verse 36, everyone recognizes that a change occurs. It goes from a past fulfillment of the prophecies, and all of a sudden at verse 36, the prophecies are recognized as future and having future fulfillment. And one of the reasons that that is recognized is because the entire section is framed by the same phrase. Verse 35 ends with the phrase, until the time of the end. And then notice in verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Then notice in verse 40, at the time of the end, of verse 11, at the time of the end, and then notice in chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, referring to the time of the end of chapter 11, verse 40. In other words, this whole section now is dealing with the end times. There's another way that we know that this section of Scripture did not have a historical fulfillment, and that is, it's never been fulfilled in history. There is nothing that matches this in the history of that part of the world. All the way up to verse 35, you are reading like right along in the history books as it relates to Antiochus Epiphanes. Once you get to verse 36, nothing like this occurred in his life. Obviously, a change has occurred, and God gives us the clues through the use of this phrase concerning the time of the end. And that's one of the reasons that we identify verses 36 through verse 39 as having to do with the Antichrist and no longer having to do with Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes never had any events like this occur in his life. And what we do read in verses 36 through 39, we know from the vantage point of having the book the books of 1 and 2 Thessalonians, the book of Revelation, we know a great deal more about the Antichrist because of the revelation that God has given us by His Holy Spirit in this covenant than Daniel ever did. And we recognize from Revelation, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, that this matches the description of the Antichrist that is there. All right, well, God gives us a portrait of the Antichrist here in verse 36. Then the king, the Antichrist, shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. That's going to be one of the characteristics of the Antichrist. He's going to exalt himself above every god. He's going to do whatever he pleases. This matches Paul's description of him for you note takers in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where he wrote to the church at Thessalonica and writes to us as believers in the Lord, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, speaking of the one we typically call the Antichrist, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God and the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And that's what the Antichrist is going to do. He is going to demand the worship of the entire world. One of the interesting things about the Antichrist is that he is going to be possessed by the devil himself. And demon possession is bad enough, but to have the head guy, to have Satan come in and possess you with that kind of power and that kind of wickedness. And that's what he's going to be. He's going to be possessed by the devil himself. And that was Satan's fall, wasn't it? His pride. He wanted to be exalted above everything else, everyone else, even God. And the Antichrist will take on his same characteristics. We're told that another characteristic of the Antichrist is that he'll speak blasphemies against the God of gods. He's going to speak blasphemies against the Lord. You might write in your margin Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 6, where we're told that the Antichrist is given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. He's given authority to continue for 42 months. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. He's going to be a big mouth, and he's going to just be full of wickedness and vileness directed toward the Lord. It's going to be one of his characteristics is the blaspheming of the Lord. John wrote in his epistles about the fact that even 2,000 years there was a spirit of Antichrist in this world, and certainly there is. Look at the blasphemy against the Lord and the things of the Lord in the entertainment, in the media, these kinds of things. And they're easy to, you know, it's easy to make these groups whipping boys. I mean, it's so simple. They're such an easy target. I feel guilty. But, I mean, what they have done in every way that they can to portray anything that is virtuous or godly or wonderful, they just defile it and they defile people. And so that spirit is already around. He'll also have the characteristic of prospering till the wrath has been accomplished for what has been determined shall be done. He's going to prosper until the wrath is accomplished. The Great Tribulation is that seven-year period where God is going to pour his wrath out upon a world that has rejected his Son, though many are going to get saved during the Great Tribulation. But that wrath that he's going to pour out here, the Antichrist is going to prosper till that wrath has come forth. And then God's going to bring an end to what the Antichrist is all about. But I like what he says there, for what has been determined shall be done. Even the Antichrist fits God's plan. Fits God's plan. It's interesting that the Antichrist is going to offer this world a choice of someone to worship other than God. And people think, you know, it's so easy to do a two-hour movie and romanticize rebellion against God. You know, romanticize wickedness. Romanticize the trampling underfoot of the marriage vow, or of sexual purity, or of honesty, or integrity. I mean, anyone can take and make it look good for 2 hours, but in real life, it doesn't work out that way. And that's one of the big gripes with the entertainment industry, is they don't show the consequences of the actions that they show on the screen. And so this world is going to have an opportunity. You don't want to worship God? It seems so terrible. All right, here's one to worship. There's nothing like God, and you'll find out that you picked the wrong one. There's no bargain in doing it. And so even the Antichrist fits God's plan because it reveals the wickedness of man's heart. Imagine rejecting Jesus Christ and then gleefully following the Antichrist. And the whole world is going to, after the church is raptured from the earth. That's the wickedness of our hearts apart from the Lord. Verse 37, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers. So we understand this to probably mean he's going to be Jewish. He's going to be Jewish. He will regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. He's going to reject the God of his fathers. Now, the Antichrist is going to be viewed by the Jews during the first 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. And the tribulation period has to do with the Jews. It doesn't have to do with the church. And so they're going to consider him their Messiah until the light goes on halfway through, which we'll get to in just a moment. But here in this place, the Jews would never consider anyone to be their Messiah who wasn't Jewish. And yet he's going to ride that Jewish thing into position and declare himself to be the Messiah. And then when the time comes, he's going to say, forget all of this worship of Yahweh or Jehovah or any of this kind of stuff. I want the whole world to worship me. So he will regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. Some people take that and they say, well, he's not going to regard the desire of women. He might be a homosexual. I don't know that that's being said there, though nothing would surprise me with this fellow. So what it seems is, he's writing to Jews. And if you were to say to a Jewish person in that day, what is the desire of women? The single greatest desire of a Jewish woman was to give birth to the Messiah. To give birth to Jesus Christ. And so the Antichrist is going to have nothing to do with the God that is Jehovah Yahweh of his people, and he will have nothing to do with the desire of women, with the Messiah, the Lord Jesus. Nor will he regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all, but in their place he shall honor a God of fortresses. And so he's going to follow the maxim that might makes right, and he's going to use military force as a means and as a threat to get his way. I don't know how thrilled or what anyone's feelings are, and I have no intention of giving you mine, as it related to our recent foray into Kosovo. But one thing that it was interesting, the Chinese's take on this, and I'm not that thrilled with the Chinese right now. I'm thrilled that they get saved, but the government, I'm not hip to spies. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. But one of the things that the Chinese came away from that NATO invasion of Kosovo came away saying was this simple sentence. They said, we now know that the United States does not need a virtuous reason to invade another country. That's how they understood it. The Russians were greatly threatened by that military action. But one of the things that we see all around us in the world today, whatever a person's political views may be or whatever it might be, you're seeing a concentration of power that is staggering. You're seeing nations and bands of nations make moves and do things that would have been unheard of in my childhood, that anyone would violate the sovereignty of another country for whatever reason in that kind of a way, for however, whatever humanitarian reasons or whatever. But you have a concentration of power and a freedom within the minds of leaders to use that power for their benefit. The Antichrist is going to use military power in order to do what it is that he wants to do, in order to get his way. As someone was talking about things to me this morning and this last week, it was interesting to see our president speak about the fact that he's determined and committed to peace in the Middle East before the end of his term. He's working hard on a legacy at this point, and that would be something that would be important to him. And then to read about the new president of Israel even considering the giving up of the Golan Heights to Syria for peace, to say nothing of what is a done deal, and that is giving up the West Bank. The things that are going around all around us on a weekly basis, all of it matches Scripture. You can't even keep up with it. It's moving that quickly. But the Antichrist is going to be one that he's going to use his power however he wants to do whatever he wants, and there might not be much, and there won't be much of a squawk about it, at least not in the first 3.5 years. And so he's going to honor a God of fortresses and a God which his fathers did not know. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones, and with pleasant things. And thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign God, and he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. So who is this foreign God that he is going to worship, that he's going to acknowledge, that he's going to advance the glory of this foreign God? It's none other than Satan himself. That's who he is going to be worshiping, receiving his power from, and moving forward. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. In other words, everyone who cooperates with him and honors him, he's going to give them position, he's going to give them authority, he's going to give them land. It's the same old thing all through history, and he's going to do it because it works. So here in the verses 36 through 39, we have a picture of the future Antichrist. And then in verse 40 through 45, we're given insight into a military struggle that's going to characterize the end of the age. The first 3.5 years of the tribulation period, the 7 years, it's going to be great. Somebody's going to get my house. But anyway, I mean, things are going to be terrific. Those dumb Christians are all going to be gone, and the Antichrist is going to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. He's going to be amazing in what he's able to do economically. It's interesting that the euro dollar began so strong just a few months ago. It's floundering at this point. We know from the scriptures that economically that area is going to flounder until someone comes in, leads it up, because that whole confederation of nations out of the old Roman Empire in the area of Europe are going to yield their sovereignty to this man in order to lead them and to lead them forward. That means they're going to be in somewhat desperate straits in order to do that. And so everything's going to be great for 3.5 years. Really be cooking for everyone in the world. They say, God, I mean, and all of the polls are going to be, are you glad the Christians are gone? 99% are glad I'm gone. You know, and it's going to look like perhaps our exiting has, you know, brought mankind into that next quantum leap that they've been waiting for, you know, in the evolutionary process and all of that nonsense. And so it goes good for 3.5 years, but then in the last 3.5 years, God begins, begins breaking seals in heaven. Jesus begins to break seals in heaven. And those seals give way to trumpets and bowls and all of the judgment that God is going to pour out on the world. And this description here in verse 40 is a description of what will happen at the very end of that final 3.5 years, what is known as the Great Tribulation. At the end, at the time of the end, so this moves us all the way to the end, the king, that is the end, the king of the south, rather, shall attack him, that is the Antichrist. And the king of the north, the Antichrist, shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. And so there's going to be the Antichrist is going to be attacked from the south. There's going to be an African army. We'll see Egypt mentioned in just a moment. There's going to be an African army led by Egypt. We know that it's going to include here, as we'll see in just a couple of verses, Ethiopia, Libya. It could be just a northern African confederation of armies, maybe Muslim-centered. But at some point toward the end of the Great Tribulation, they get sick of this whole Antichrist thing, and they decide they're going to revolt against him. And so the Antichrist comes down against them. Verse 41, he shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So this army comes up against to begin an invasion force to the north against the Antichrist. The Antichrist sees it coming, moves against them. They fight their battle in the region of the glorious land, that is Israel, and he pretty much decimates them at that particular point. It is fascinating that we're told in verse 41 that the everything's going to be overthrown, but Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon are going to escape the Antichrist's hand. Those areas are what are known today as modern-day Jordan. And the fascinating thing about modern-day Jordan as it relates to the whole end times picture, you look and you say, boy, he's wiping out all these other armies. Why doesn't he wipe these armies and these countries out too? The fascinating thing is that at the 3.5-year mark of the Great Tribulation, when the Antichrist sets up the abomination that causes desolation, he sets up this image of himself in the rebuilt temple and demands the world to worship him. At that time, Jesus said, when you see that happen to the Jews, he said, don't go get your jacket, don't go get anything, run for your life. And he told them to escape from the Antichrist, and at that point the Jews will realize that the Antichrist is the Antichrist and not their Messiah. But in Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 12, we're told that the devil, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. And when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, that is Satan, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, speaking of Jesus, persecuted the Jews. But the woman was given two wings as of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, that is 1 year, times 2 years and a half time, half a year, 3.5 years, she's nourished from the presence of the serpent. The Antichrist then spews out water, a flood from his mouth, after the woman, speaking of an army, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth, swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth, chasing after these Jews. Somehow something happens and God stops all of that. So somehow, when these Jews flee, they flee out to the wilderness. To flee to the wilderness is to flee to the east, to the desert, to flee toward the region of Jordan. Isaiah spoke about this, and he said in that prophecy, he said to the area of modern-day Jordan, take counsel, Isaiah chapter 16, verses 1 through 4, take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the light in the middle of the day. And then God said, hide the outcasts. Do not betray him who escapes. Let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler. So the Jews are going to flee into the wilderness. They're going to find refuge in the region of Jordan. And because the Jewish people are there at that time, God is going to protect that region of Jordan, known anciently as Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And all of it fits here with, you know, these little details that he gives concerning the Antichrist. So that region is going to be unharmed for that region. And then for that reason. And then verse 42, he stretches out his hand against the countries that invaded against him, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt. So he goes further down, invades Egypt, takes their wealth. Also, the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. And so he moves into their wealth and taking from them, they probably having joined the Egyptians in the fight against the Antichrist. While he's doing this, news comes from the east and from the north that will trouble him. So he's going to be moving down to the south to quell this rebellion. And while he's down there, he's going to get word, we got trouble up north and we got trouble to the east. Now, the news that comes from the north appears to be an invasion that occurs from Russia. Russia apparently is somewhat recovered from the massive defeat that they experience at what I think is the beginning of the tribulation period in Ezekiel 38 and 39. They get sick of the Antichrist deal right now, so they come down. They probably see this as an opportune time to come against them. They come down with their armies. And then there is some army that comes out of the east that troubles the Antichrist. And that's probably the 200 million man army from the east that's described in Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 through 17. An army that crosses the Euphrates, so they have to come from the east of the Euphrates, speaking of Asia. And John writes there, and he says, "Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them." And then in Revelation 16:12, "The great river Euphrates and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared." So that there is an army that comes from the east. It's a 200 million man army. I mean, look out. Now, one of the interesting things is that Time magazine reported on May 21st, 1965, that China was capable of fielding an army of 200 million. Kind of a weird number to just kind of talk about, you know, for a secular magazine, and you read the Revelation and you read about this army coming out of the east during that great tribulation period, and China being fully capable of doing it back in 1965 and more fully capable of doing it in this day. So he hears this news coming from the north, perhaps Russia, come the east, perhaps China with their army. It troubles him. And then notice in the last half of verse 44, "Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many." He's really upset. How dare they attack me? I mean, he's not used to any kind of opposition or anything, so he gets really upset about it. And then in verse 45, "He shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one shall help him." So furiously, he comes up from his invasion against Africa. He sets his tents, his military command, between the seas and the holy mountain, probably sets up his military camp between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean Sea, which is in the southern portion of Israel. It's a staging area for him to then move north to fight against the armies that are coming from the east and the north. And do you know what lies immediately to the north of his staging area? Is a great big valley known as Megiddo. And it will be there that these great armies of the world will gather together to fight against one another. Some of the biggest battles in the history of the world have been fought in that valley through ancient times into World War I, World War II, many battles fought there. There's a great battle of the end days that's going to be fought there. They will gather together there to fight against one another. And at that moment, when they're just about to decimate one another, all of a sudden, we're told at the end of Revelation that Jesus returns and a sword comes out of his mouth. As Jesus returns at his second coming, they'll forget about their hostility with one another, and now they'll join together to fight against God. But anyway, they're going to do it. You know, and that's what God does in Psalm 2. You know, you've got these kings that have gone mad, you know, imagining vain things and all related to the Lord, and it says, "What will the Lord do in heaven? He'll laugh." The Lord returns, the word goes out of his mouth, they're slaughtered in the valley of Megiddo, all of them joined in rebellion against the Lord. The blood is so high, or the bodies are so high, that it's as high as a horse's bridle throughout the entire valley. And if you ever get a chance to go there and look across that great big valley, you realize how many bodies are going to be stacked one upon another. Sometimes people think of the Battle of Armageddon as being some big battle, you know, some long, drawn-out thing. It's not. It's just one sentence out of Jesus' mouth, something like, "This is ridiculous," or, "I don't know what. Who do you guys think you are?" Boom! But the sword out of his mouth, the sword is the Word of God. He just speaks whatever, and it's done. It's not like he's going to break a sweat, or he's going to call in reinforcements, or anything like that. It's a cinch for him. But man in his pride thinks that he can fight against God and has a chance to break free of God and take control of what is God's, and that is planet Earth. But they're not going to be successful in their rebellion. For those of you who are note takers in your margin, you can write down in that by that verse, Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 through 21, which speaks of Jesus' return at that time. And then Psalm 2, verses 1 through 12, which speaks about the nations raging and the people plotting a vain thing, the idea that they could overthrow God. And so they think that they're going to do that, and then notice at the end of verse 45 that yet he shall come to his end, the Antichrist is going to come to his end, and no one will help him. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, will be the end of the Antichrist. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. No one can deliver the Antichrist at that point. The Lord's got his target on him. And then in Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 through 21, it speaks of Jesus returning on a white horse, his name being called Faithful and True, and he makes war and he judges in righteousness. He returns and is a part of that destruction there in the Battle of Armageddon. He also wipes out the Antichrist and the beast, and they are thrown into the lake of fire during the thousand-year reign of Christ. And so a portrait of the future Antichrist, and then a picture of the battle that's going to characterize the end of the age right up to the Lord's return. Chapter 12, some prophecies concerning the distant future continued. At that time, that is the last days, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Michael seemed to have a great interest in the Jewish people. He seemed to be the angel that was assigned to them. And the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, speaking of the Jews, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And so verse 1 is an encapsulation of the great tribulation, and the Lord is telling Daniel that this period at the end is going to be the worst thing that your people have ever seen, and they are a nation who have seen terrible things. And then in verse 2, he says, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt." And so God speaks to Daniel concerning the fact that there's going to be a resurrection. There isn't a lot in the Old Testament that speaks about the resurrection. Job speaks about it a little bit. Daniel learns about it a little bit here. But there's going to be a resurrection. God declares to Daniel, some are going to be resurrected to everlasting life, and some are going to be resurrected to shame and everlasting contempt. Every individual has another history beyond this world, and that we're going to be resurrected into. Those that love the Lord, have trusted in the Lord, we're going to be resurrected into everlasting life. And then those that reject the Lord will be resurrected at the white throne judgment at the end of the millennium to everlasting contempt. Notice that it speaks of everlasting contempt. There is no such thing as annihilation, as I think the Jehovah's Witnesses teach, and also the Seventh-day Adventists. It is everlasting, and there are other verses that bring that forth. There is no annihilation. We live beyond this life, and the key is to make choices in this life that are consistent with what we want in the life to come. Verse 3, those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And so there is going to be, he's speaking to the Jews now, probably talking about the tribulation saints. When the rapture of the church occurs at the beginning of the, before the great tribulation period starts, because that constitutes the wrath of God and we haven't been appointed unto wrath. And so when we're raptured prior to that tribulation period, one of the interesting things that happens is a lot of people are going to get saved during that time. Now, don't not get saved tonight. Because you say, well, I'll get saved when, you know, grandma's raptured. Yeah, you don't have the confidence that you'll be here tomorrow or even later tonight, much less when grandma gets raptured. And so you want to get saved tonight. But there will be a lot that goes on that is spiritually wonderful during that great tribulation. There are going to be the two witnesses Elijah is one of them. We don't know who the other one is. Might be Moses, who are going to, for the first 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation, they're going to be speaking the things of the Lord during that whole time. They're going to be speaking about turning to the Lord and all until their ministry is over, and they're taken out midway through the Great Tribulation. In Revelation chapter 7, we're told that there's 144,000 male virgin Jews that are going to be preaching during the Great Tribulation period. Many are going to listen, give heed, and come to know the Lord during that time. Also, we're told, I think it's in chapter 12 of Revelation, that an angel's going to go forth throughout the whole world declaring the everlasting gospel. So when the Jews realize that the Antichrist is the Antichrist and not their Messiah, with all of this going on, the preaching going on, the truth going forth, both Jew and Gentile alike, many of them are going to get saved. And having become saved during the Great Tribulation, they'll have to give their life for their faith, because no one can buy or sell without taking the mark of the beast, and no one can go into heaven if they take the mark of the beast. And so they'll be persecuted, they'll be beheaded for their faith, and yet it looks like they'll be very active in their service to the Lord during that time. And there is a place in Revelation where we find them up in heaven in a beautiful position of reward for having been faithful to the Lord during that Great Tribulation period. And so there's going to be a reward for those that are righteous and give themselves to the things of the Lord during the Great Tribulation. In other words, God says there's a reward associated with righteousness. Then he says in verse 4, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall go run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." So, verse 4, God says, all right, the prophecy from chapter 10 to chapter 12, verse 4, it's over. Daniel, you've got it written down. Close up the book. I'm done. We're done with the prophecy here. It's all over. And he said, seal the book. And notice that it's not to be sealed forever. Seal it until the time of the end. And one of the things that's interesting is that the implication is, and we'll see it in just a couple of verses, but that at the end times, people would understand the book in a way that Daniel couldn't. And we read Daniel today, and we can understand it so well. And it's a revelation of the fact that we are in these last times. Now, he talks about the time of the end, and he speaks of these characteristics of many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. And so is he talking about McHenry at 5 o'clock? Is he talking about computers? What is he talking about here? Now, one of the things that is interesting about this running to and fro and knowledge increasing in the last days is there is this increased activity and pace of life in the last days. We see it all around us, don't we? Things are moving faster and faster and faster. And we also see that knowledge is increasing. The world's gotten very small through travel. Get on a plane, be somewhere on the other side of the world before the day is over. And so the technology in terms of transportation has made the world very small. And then you have now the computers that allow us to increase our knowledge, double our knowledge at a staggering kind of rates. The interesting thing about the fulfillment of some of these prophecies of the end times is that they would have required a greater technology and knowledge than was there at the time of Daniel. The Bible speaks of the last days as being a time under the Antichrist when the world will have a cashless society. That was impossible in Daniel's time. But it's not impossible for us. We're well on our way there because of the computers and the technology that we have. The scriptures talk about the fact that halfway through the Great Tribulation period, when the two witnesses, Elijah and perhaps Moses or whoever the other one is, when they're killed and their bodies are lying in the streets there of Jerusalem, that the whole world is going to watch that. That could have never been fulfilled in Daniel's time. You'd have had to have been in Jerusalem to see it. But now with the satellites and all, they can beam in, CNN, probably be fully staffed, and they'll be able to just take just, okay. And so Here, because of satellites and all, the whole world will be able to watch that. Also, there had to be, to fulfill these scriptures concerning the last days, there had to be a means by which militarily man had the capacity to destroy himself. And it's only been in these recent decades that we've had that capacity. When I got saved back in 1980, they had Greg Laurie down there at Riverside. They put out a little magazine. It was just an outstanding magazine. I don't know why, you know, they do so many things, and so things run their course and they let them go. But they were talking about the nuclear armaments and weaponry of the world at that time. We're talking about 1981, 1982. And at that time, we had enough, it was estimated, to destroy all life on planet Earth seven times over. Seven times over. That's almost 20 years ago. I don't know what we're able to do today, but we have the capacity, man does, for destroying himself. As Jesus said in the Olivet Discourse, speaking about the last days, "For then there shall be a great tribulation such as never been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor shall ever be, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days were shortened." And so, perhaps it talks about travel, perhaps it's talking about technology and knowledge. It's also just as possible that what he's talking about here also, that in the last days there's going to be an active going to and fro through the prophetic scriptures. And surely the Jews will do that during the Great Tribulation period as things turn from bad to worse and them pinning their hopes upon the wrong man. And then as they become active in their going to and fro through the prophetic scriptures, the result will be increased knowledge or increased understanding of those scriptures. And of course, we see the fulfillment of that aspect of things in these last days also. Very little about the prophecies of Daniel here that we don't understand pretty clearly in these last days. And then verse 5, "I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank and the other on that riverbank." So riverbanks in the Bible. And it's talking about nothing about their theaters. But anyway, it's talking about angelic beings here, doubtless angelic beings. One is on one side of the Tigris and the other is on the bank on the other side of the Tigris River, which was introduced to us in chapter 10. And one said to the other, one said to the man who was clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, he said, How long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? And then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand, he held both hands in up toward heaven, speaking of a solemn kind of oath. And then he swore by him, that is God, who lives forever. In other words, what he's going to say here now can't be broken, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time, and when the power of the holy people, the Jews, has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. And so the angel, the one angel asks, how long? And concerning this great tribulation, the worst half of the great tribulation, and the one angel says a time, which is 1 year, times, which would be 2 years added to that, and a half a time, you have 3.5 years, which matches the rest of what the scriptures say about the tribulation period. And although I heard, verse 8, I did not understand. Daniel's listening to all of this, and he's like some of you. Although I heard every word that guy said. Well, mostly every word that he said. I did drift a little bit. But although I heard, I did not understand. Daniel wasn't understanding everything here. And then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? In other words, I'm hearing you, but I'm not putting this together. And then the angel said to Daniel, Daniel, go your way, for the words are closed up and sealed, not forever, but till the time of the end. Daniel, they're not for you. You're not going to understand them. Neat thing, though, Daniel did want to understand. He was a student of the scriptures and a student of prophecy. He wanted to understand, but God said, no, you'll never be able to understand this in your day, Daniel. Your job is to deliver it, and then we'll leave it to be understood at the time of the end. And many shall be purified, made white and refined, speaking of during the Great Tribulation period, those that get saved during that period turn to the Lord. They'll really pay a price for their faith, and they'll be made white and refined as a result of it. But the wicked during that 3.5 years that was just spoken of by the angel, they're going to do wickedly. They're going to love to do wickedly. Their heart's going to be revealed. And none of the wicked shall understand the prophetic scriptures, but the wise shall understand. In other words, during that great tribulation period, when the light goes on for the Jews, they are going to dig into these scriptures and understand them like they've never understood them before. And in verse 11, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. This is really one of the most amazing prophecies in the entirety of the Bible. Daniel is told here that a day is coming when the daily sacrifice is going to be taken away. In other words, the temple's going to be built, and the daily sacrifices are going to be resumed. But on one day in particular, those daily sacrifices are going to be stopped, and then on that same day, the abomination of desolation is going to be set up, the same one that Jesus spoke of in Matthew chapter 24. The abomination of desolation, literally the abomination that causes desolation, is that the Antichrist is going to allow the Jews to rebuild their temple, which they're very eager to do today. He'll allow them to rebuild their temple. They'll have a great time for 3.5 years in their rebuilt temple. At the 3.5 year mark, he says, listen, I'm not sharing my glory with anybody else. And he takes and he sets himself, he walks into the Holy of Holies, sets up what appears to be an image of himself, the Holy of Holies, which will be shocked to Jews, and he will demand to be worshipped. That is the abomination that causes desolation. That is abomination that defiles the temple. Defiles the temple. And so here he'll come in, and God said, from that day there'll be 1,290 days. If you're there, God forbid, but if you're there, anyone that's there, they can read their Modesto B. I make no other comment. But they'll be able to read their Modesto B, and they'll be able to note the day. This is the day that the Antichrist went in and took over the Holy of Holies of the rebuilt temple of the Jews. And then you can take on your calendar and start to mark 1,290 days. And on the 1,290th day, the end comes, and you have the day of the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. Interesting to me that he gave the very day of Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem there in Daniel chapter 9, but he dated it off a historical event. In the same way, he gives the date of the second coming of Jesus Christ, but he dates it off of a particular event. It's one of the reasons I do not believe in a post-tribulation rapture. I do not believe that the rapture and the second coming can occur at the same time, because in light of this prophecy, we will know the day and the hour of the return of Jesus Christ, at least for 1,290 days the earth will, and the rapture will occur when no man knows the day or the hour. So they have to be two entirely different events. And then Daniel is told, blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. So you have the 1,290 days, and you factor in the autumnal equinox times the... I'm just kidding. just testing here. So you have the 1,290 days, and then here is a 1,335 days, 45-day difference. And so he says, listen, whoever makes it to the 1,335 days, blessed is that person. Something happens here for a 45-day period, and there's a lot of conjecture about what in the world it might be that happens during that extra 45 days. No one really knows, but that doesn't stop us from speculating as it relates to it. Following the Battle of Armageddon, you're going to have a whole valley that needs to be cleansed of all of those dead bodies. That may take some time in order to do. The temple is going to have been defiled by the Antichrist, and so I am under the assumption that that temple is going to be destroyed because it is irreparably defiled, and that a new temple is going to be built, as is spoken of in the later chapters of the book of Ezekiel. There's also, Jesus spoke of a judgment that was going to occur between the sheep and the goats at the end of the age. In other words, some people will survive the Great Tribulation, and they will be judged. Some that come to the end of that great tribulation, they will have survived, faithful to the Lord. Somehow they survive. They're the sheep. They get put in one category. Those that have survived the great tribulation and they've taken the mark of the beast and given themselves to the worship of the Antichrist, they're the goats. They're put in another category, removed from the scene until the white throne judgment. And then those that are the sheep, including Jews and Gentiles, will be those that make up the population of the earth during the thousand-year reign. All of that may take some time. And so different events that could occur during that 45-day period of what was that is spoken of here by the angel. But you, Daniel, go your way till the end. For you shall rest. Daniel, you're going to die before all of this happens. And you shall rise in your inheritance at the end of the days. Daniel, leave it with the Lord. Good boy. Good job, Daniel. You're faithful all the way to the end. You listened, you wrote it down, and you've been faithful, and you're going to die before all happens. You're going to be raised to enjoy the inheritance that is found in those that look forward to and look back upon God's Messiah, the Lord Jesus. There's an end of days that's coming, and it's going to be God's end. It's going to be God's end. It's fun to listen, watch the newspaper, and I am as hopelessly addicted as I've ever been. Though I did cut out the Chronicle. Have you noticed I'm a little more relaxed? Have you noticed that? Just a little bit. But an end is coming. An end coming is going to be God's end. And I'm so glad to be saved tonight. Look at all of these prophecies, and you've listened to me for almost an hour tonight. And you look at, and everyone has more or less interest in some of these things, or growing in a knowledge of these things. And we look at this little thing, and it could be that, and we look at that, and we say, we know that this is this, and all of these little details that are so specific and so fascinating really, really are so needed, because otherwise God wouldn't have recorded them. But the gist of the whole book is not so much all of that. All the way through the book of Daniel, there is one message that's communicated in a thousand different ways over and over again. And the message is, God is in control of man's history. He is in control of what's happening on this earth. He began it, and he's going to bring it to close, and he's going to bring it to his close. And so I can take that deep Jack-O-Lane breath, the mighty Wurlitzer. Inhale, exhale. Grab a chair, everybody. Come on, let's go here. You know, so, but we can just relax. He is in charge. And in effect, through the book of Daniel, he says, listen, what more can I do to show you that I am in charge than what I have laid out concerning the past and fulfilled, has been fulfilled to perfection, and then laid out what you see being fulfilled before your eyes every day here in these last days. Let me close with this. The book of Daniel, we'll pick up the pace now when we head into Hosea, but I wanted to slow down in the book of Daniel because it ties to so many other sections, especially the prophetic scriptures in the Bible. I wanted to take it a little bit at a time. But the book of Daniel, first six chapters, lessons for God's children who are living far away from home. That's us. We're far away from heaven. So maybe just to provoke your memory, chapter 1, that the life of holiness and faithfulness to God can be lived under the most extraordinary pressures against us doing so. Chapter 2, the Lord is in control even when the world looks out of control. Chapter 3, the Lord will work even through the most fiery trials that we face and we find ourselves in because we won't compromise, and he'll be faithful to work those trials together for his glory and for our good. In chapter 4, the Lord is able to humble the most powerful men on planet earth like he did with Nebuchadnezzar. Sometimes I look and I say, God, why don't you just feed them their lunch and done with it, you know? And God says, because that doesn't fit in my plan. I wish he'd send me a badge coach. But he doesn't do that. And when God doesn't humble the most powerful men on the earth that are doing the kind of damage that they do, when he doesn't do it, he does do it because somehow it's serving his purposes. In chapter 5, the Lord's able to defend himself and to defend his reputation. In chapter 6, it's just like chapter 1. And that is the message of no compromise, that we can live a life of no compromise. But from a different vantage point, in chapter 1, we're taught about the possibility of living a life without compromise from the vantage point of youth. Daniel is a young man. In chapter 6, we're taught that it's possible to live a life of no compromise, far away from home, from the vantage point of old age. Daniel, related to that lion's den. Daniel's life of no compromise, it began as a commitment in his youth, and it ended as an acknowledgement in his old age. In chapters 7 through 12, man's sins and man's rebellion is all going to come to an end. It's sure. God wins. Make sure you're on the winning side. Make sure you're on the winning side. If you're here tonight and you've never given your life to the Lord, I want to give you an opportunity to do that tonight. I leave this place on Sunday nights and I just pinch myself that anyone came back. You know, it would be a bummer to have two people in the room. But I have the time of my life. I love assembling with you. I love it. I need it. I love it. But I have the idea or the assumption that I'll ever stand behind this wooden box ever again. Things can happen. They can happen to me individually. But things can happen just in the earth. The time is at hand for the Lord to blow that trumpet and for us to be pulled up into heaven and that great tribulation to begin. I never assume that there's going to be another chance for you to receive the Lord, and I hope you don't assume that you'll have another chance other than tonight. If you sit here tonight and you're not saved, that is, there's never been a time in your life where you said to God, God, you're right in your assessment of me. I'm a sinner. And God, I believe that my sin has separated me from a relationship with you. And I believe that because I have this empty spot in my life and this loneliness that I feel every day. I feel every day because I was made for relationship with you. And I believe that you loved me so much that you sent your Son to die on the cross to pay the price for the forgiveness of my sins. I believe that he died. I believe this again on the third day, and I trust in that salvation that you've provided. God, I turn my ways. I turn your way. My life is yours, lock, stock, and barrel. Do it as you please. And if you'd like to do that tonight, God's Holy Spirit will come into your life. You'll be born again by the Holy Spirit. Your name will be written in the book of life, and none of this horror will be our future, no potential for it. All heaven will be your home. And you'll finally get to experience the life that God has for you. Thus far, you've experienced the life that you had for you. Others have had for you all the junk, you know. It's time to experience the life that God has for you. Is a life and death important in this life? It is important beyond our imagination concerning the life to come that you make the right choice concerning eternity.